session number 9965, reel 1.
Mr. Dimmery, Reel 1. Can you tell me about your family background, Mr. Dimmery?
Yes, well, I lost my dad in the First World War. I have one sister, or I had one sister anyway. In one respect, I was an only child, inasmuch that my sister was older than myself, and you know what it is, older sisters, they're not interested in kid brothers, so... In one respect, I was very much a loner. I've always been interested in mechanical matters, engines and such like, and this eventually led to employment with the Air Ministry as an aero engine fitter.
How old were you when your father was killed?
Oh, three, I think. Three. I don't remember my dad. At three, and things were pretty tough. To be quite honest, I don't know how my mother managed, because the pension received in those days from, say, 1920-22 onwards was an absolute pittance. And in her case, it remained exactly the same until the day she died in 1965. So if you care to work out what the values were are in 1965 as against today's values, I really don't know how she managed. However, both my sister and I had a good education. I don't really know how it was paid for. I've got an idea an association probably paid for it in some way or other. Anyway, as I say, I was keen on engineering, and I eventually ended up at the beginning of the war working in the Air Ministry. I was at a couple of aerodromes, first of all in Shawbury near Shrewsbury, and then I moved to Cosford near Wolverhampton. That would be in about 1940.
Can you remember the actual outbreak of war?
Oh, yes. Yes. I was in Shrewsbury at the time. It was a little bit of a shock to hear the actual announcement. And my sister, who was married to a regular army private, was up in Yorkshire. And so I thought I'd better go up and have a chat with her. So on that morning, I got out my motorcycle and I went up to Yorkshire. I came back the same day. And, well, that was it, really. As I say, within a few months, I was posted then to Cosford, Wolverhampton.
What sort of qualifications did you have by then?
Not much, really. It's just that one acquires a fair amount of information as one works on aero engines, and I'd been on various courses learning the ins and outs of various aero equipment, and dare I say it came fairly easy to me because I was that way inclined. And then, as I say, whilst at Cosford, ATA had been in existence about 6 months or so, I should imagine, maybe a little longer. And then with the advent of the heavier aircraft, the bombers and such like, it was pretty obvious that they needed some assistance to help a pilot fly these aircraft. So they sent a notice round to the various maintenance units in the Air Ministry asking for volunteers, and I decided that this is something I'd like to try, so I volunteered.
Before we go on to that, could you just tell me what your duties had been at Cosford?
I was purely an aero engine fitter. It was pretty hard work too, because the aircraft were mostly parked outside in the open, and it was winter time. The snow was quite thick and heavy in those early years, 1940, 41, 42, and some of the work entailed being outside in the snow. The snow, perhaps on one occasion, I can remember quite clearly, being at least 3 feet deep. And we had to sweep the snow off the wings and the tailplanes of the aircraft. And in those days, the aircraft tanks had to be emptied of the petrol. And I can remember quite well how difficult it was to undo petrol taps and pipes to drain the tanks. And occasionally, of course, the petrol would swill over your hands. It was intensely cold, and quite frankly, I could have cried on many occasions. However, we used to do it, and that pattern went on for quite a long time, until such time as I say, I transferred to ATA, which was early 42.
Was this a reserved occupation?
Yes, it was to a certain extent. Every now and again, some lads would in fact get call-up papers, but some of us, with a little bit more experience than others, for some reason best known to the powers that be, seemed to be ignored, and I was one of those people. But it's quite possible, of course, that I would have been called up eventually, but there's no knowing how it would have worked out.
Did you ever consider volunteering?
I thought about it, but I felt that I was doing something to help the war effort. But at the back of my mind, I still felt that my mum had given up her husband, and I felt that I didn't want to be a hero and stick my neck out unnecessarily. But at the same time, I did feel that I wanted to do something. But I wasn't in a hurry to volunteer. And I suppose if the truth be known, I probably would not have pushed myself to volunteer.
What happened when you heard that ATA was recruiting?
Well, as I say, I always had a desire to fly, and I thought this was a wonderful opportunity. So it didn't take much encouragement on my part to put my name forward. I don't know how many put their names forward. I think it ran into hundreds. I've got an idea it might have been as many as 300 or 400. I'm not too certain. This was all over the country, of course, not just at Cosford. And I think about 25 were in fact selected, and I was one of them.
What did they say they were looking for when they asked for volunteers?
Well, they wanted people with the ability to maintain aero engines and obviously had an inclination to be of service in the air in some way or other.
How did your employers react?
Well, I don't think there were any objections. Remember, I was working for the Air Ministry, and ATA and the Air Ministry were very, very closely allied. And I suppose one could say it was just another department, if you like, of the Air Ministry. Although, in point of fact, our contract was with BOAC. They did all the administrative work in the early days, and they paid us our money, or at least that's how it worked out on paper.
Could you describe to me the actual procedure for volunteering?
Oh, golly, it was a long time ago.
Were you selected for interview?
Oh, yes, yes. I just put my name forward, and from what I can recollect, a number of us went for an interview. We were asked whether we had ever flown before, what would we do in certain circumstances in the event of, a gauge showing a low oil pressure, something like that, and we had to give what we considered a suitable reply. I really forget where the interview took place.
Do you know what they were looking for?
Well, yes, they must have known what they were looking for. They obviously... The point is, a pilot cannot fly a four-engine machine on his own. He might be able to fly it straight and level, but in the event of an emergency, it's impossible for a pilot, perhaps, to, say, get the wheels down in an emergency, something like that. It's a two-man job. And... obviously, this is the kind of person they wanted. They wanted an assistant to fly the aircraft. This is what it's all about.
And how much did you understand what your job would entail?
Well, I had a good idea, yes. I had a good idea what it was going to be all about.
Had you ever been in the air?
Oh, yes, a couple of times. When we maintained the aircraft on the ground at Cosford, they sometimes... used to ask the fitters who had worked on the aircraft to go up with them, sort of a sign that they were satisfied that they'd done their work in a competent manner. Actually, I jumped at the idea of going up. I was all for it. And I went up several times, yes.
How did you feel when you heard you had been selected for ATM?
Very pleased. Very pleased indeed. A little, had a few qualms. I didn't really know, perhaps, what was going to happen in the future. But at the same time, I was pleased that I had been chosen. And I don't really remember how I reported. I think the headquarters of ATA were at White Waltham near Maidenhead, and somehow or other I made my way to Maidenhead. I forget who I saw, I don't really remember. But I know that there had been about 22 or 3 or 4 before me, and I was probably one of the last of this first batch to report. We were fixed up with accommodation, from what I remember, in Diggs in Maidenhead. We all asked each other, I suppose, what did they know? Did anybody know what was the program, what was going to happen? But eventually, of course, it all came to the surface. We found out that we would have to go on courses and be introduced to these larger aircraft.
Did you have a training program to go through?
Oh, yes. Yes. From what I remember, we had a training school, a sort of classroom, if I remember correctly, and we got a bit of information there of what we were expected to do. And then after a while, we were taken to Thruxton, where we were shown for the first time a Halifax, which was considered the basic four-engine bomber. And we were taken up in this Halifax, and we watched what a flight engineer had to do during takeoff. What he had to do during the flight, straight and level flight, what he had to do on the approach and for landing purposes. After we'd studied this for some time, we were invited to have a go ourselves, to do exactly the same as we'd had already seen. I forget how many times we did it, but there was no real problem. And then we were flown back to White Waltham, and I think we were encouraged to make up our notes and refresh our memories. And I think this went on for quite some time. If I looked at my logbook, I could probably find out.
What about technical instruction?
Well, we had technical officers in ATA who were able to pass on their knowledge to us. And it was from them that we learnt the technique of acting as a flight engineer and that. But most of us had technical knowledge about engines and aircraft in general anyway. That's how we'd been chosen in the first place.
How familiar were you with this type of aircraft?
I wasn't familiar at all up until then. You see, certain aerodromes in Air Ministry concentrated on certain types of aircraft. For instance, at Cosford, we had vast numbers of Spitfires and Blenheims. But there were no four-engine aircraft of any kind. But doubtless in other parts of the country, there must have been aerodromes which had four-engine aircraft. But as I say, these were the early days of ATA, and the four-engine aircraft were only just putting in an appearance in about 1941, I should imagine, and this was now early 42. So really, people didn't know too much about four-engine aircraft at all. It was something that we had to learn rather quickly.
How easy did you find it to learn the duties of a flight engineer?
It wasn't too difficult. We had, as I say, we had school, sort of lessons in school, as it were, and we had the layout of the aircraft. We were shown the tank arrangements, the various arrangements for storing petrol. We were shown the hydraulic systems, things like that, the pneumatic systems, and we were shown how to transfer petrol from one tank to another. At least we were shown on paper how to do it. And then after a while, of course, we were introduced to the aircraft and we were shown exactly where these various controls were for hydraulics, pneumatics, petrol controls, and all the rest of it. We soon got the hang of it. It wasn't all that difficult, really.
How adequate did you find this training?
Oh, it was necessary, very, very necessary indeed, yes. And it was absolutely essential to know all these bits and pieces. A person couldn't have managed without some knowledge. And in point of fact, ATA developed a very fine book of handling notes for all aircraft, including, well, when I say all aircraft, I really mean all the aircraft they flew. The flight engineers eventually had a book of their own, which actually contained rather more information than a pilot's handbook, because it would contain the layouts of the petrol tanks and the methods for getting the wheels down and for getting the flaps down in an emergency, things like that. I've got a book here now, actually, one of the original books, and it's a collector's item these days.
What was your opinion of it?
A marvellous book altogether. The book itself, in fact, the RAF, they would have given, members of the RAF would have given their right arm to have got hold of some of these books, because an ATA pilot only had to be given a chit to collect an aircraft He'd get out his book, and immediately there was all the information he needed on handling this particular type of aircraft. And there was absolutely no problem.
Did you ever find there were any omissions or mistakes?
Yes. But these were very, very soon corrected. And the notes were brought up to date as soon as anything happened which required alteration. The books were modified. The relevant details were... the pages were torn out and exchanged for an up-to-date page.
What happened to you once your training had finished?
Well, as I say, the basic training for four-engine aircraft was the Halifax. So we were sent to various ferry pools. There are about 16 ferry pools throughout the country. In my case, I was sent to Ringway, which is near Manchester, and was Ringway was in the heart of the four-engine aircraft industry, really. Halifaxes were made at Preston, and the Lancasters were made at Woodford, near Wimslow. So we were sent to, in my case, I was sent to Ringway, and very soon we had a chance to deliver a Halifax from Preston. To do this, we were allocated to a pilot, and a group of pilots would be flown then from Ringway to, in my case, of course, to Preston to pick up a Halifax. The Halifax would be flown then from Preston to a bomber station, say, in Yorkshire. Halifaxes generally went to Yorkshire, whilst Lancasters generally went to Lincolnshire. The technique was to go to the factory. We'd have a chit saying that a certain aircraft had to be taken to an aerodrome in Yorkshire. The flight engineer's job at this stage would be to make a visual check around the aircraft, checking anything that required a visual check, a sort of tires, oleo legs, locking controls, and then inside the aircraft, the amount of petrol would be checked. Various things. I'm a bit out of date now. It's 40 years ago. But just as you would check your car in the morning before going out, you'd check petrol and oil and things like that. And then when the pilot had done his paperwork, he'd come along. We'd start the aircraft up. We'd satisfy that all engines were delivering full power, and then we would taxi away from the hard standing and eventually take off for our destination. Because the trips were comparatively short, say 35 minutes, 45 minutes, sometimes a bit longer, most of the pilots had flown the trips many times. They didn't really need a map. But when the weather was bad, then, of course, the maps were more in evidence. The station to which we would be going would have already had a telephone message to say that we were on our way. And usually there'd be no trouble in finding the aerodrome, and then it would be a case of coming into land. During this, prior to this, the flight engineer, of course, would have been checking the various gauges, petrol gauge quantities, oil pressures, oil temperatures, because very often these gauges were not even visible by the pilot. They would sometimes, in the case of a Halifax, be actually behind the pilot, so he couldn't possibly see them. During the trip, the flight engineer would be keeping a check on a clipboard showing exactly temperatures and pressures every quarter of an hour of the engines, all four engines. Then for landing, the pilot would make a circuit of the aerodrome, and the technique would be to line up with the aerodrome. The pilot would ask then for various conditions of the engine, for instance, the airspeed would be checked. He would be controlling the airspeed with the throttles. He would select. He would ask for the wheels to be lowered. It would be necessary to check that the wheels were locked down. Sometimes there would have to be a visual check on the part of the flight engineer. He might have to go to some part that the pilot couldn't possibly see and check visually that a lock was in position. The flaps would have to be lowered a certain number of degrees. The speed would have to be called out by the flight engineer because the pilot would be concentrating on lining up with the aircraft. And at the final approach of all, the pilot would ask for full flap. The flaps would have to go down all the way. And then after touchdown, it would be a case of trundling along the runway, then raising the flaps, switching off various items which were no longer used in on the ground, taxiing to the dispersal point, and that would be it.
When you were airborne, how could you communicate with your pilot?
We had no means of communication other than verbally speaking to the pilot. We didn't use radio or anything at all like that. It was purely mouth-to-mouth, as it were, yes.
Was the noise of the engines a problem?
Not really. You closed windows and things like that, and maybe you shouted, but one really knew exactly what was wanted because it's like lip reading. You know exactly. If you work in an atmosphere which is noisy, after a while you get very adept at lip reading and you can carry on a conversation quite well. And I think this must have happened in our case, although obviously speech was necessary. You could hear, yes.
Would you be sitting beside the pilot?
Sometimes, but not always. Certain pieces of equipment, as I say, were behind the pilot. They had to be watched, and one couldn't sit down and watch at the same time. You'd have to perhaps stand up and look at the instruments. One little thing about during the takeoff, it was the flight engineer's job to watch very, very carefully that the revs of each engine remained absolutely constant and that no engine cut out. Because of the design of the propellers, it was possible for an engine to cut out and therefore lose all its power, but the wind, the slipstream, could make the engine rotate at the same speed as the other ones. And unless you noted exactly when an engine cut out, you could be utterly confused as to which engine was, in fact, not delivering its maximum power. If an engine did cut out, it was essential that that engine should be feathered, that the propeller should be feathered, so that there would be less resistance to the slipstream.